certain operas can change your life through a vision of serenity, wisdom, and courage that lifts you to some nobler, higher place. Francis Poulenc's Dialogue des Carmélites, Dialogues of the Carmelites, is one of those operas. I'm Roger Pines, dramaturg of Lyric Opera of Chicago. I'm pleased to present a commentary on Carmelites, my favorite of all French operas. Carmelites premiered in Italian, but it was written in French and was recorded by its first French cast in 1957. Excerpts from that performance will illustrate this commentary. The principals are Denise Duval as Blanche, Régine Crespin as Madame Lidoine, Denise Charlet as Madame de Croissy, Rita Gore as Mother Marie, Liliane Bertin as Constance, Xavier Duprat as the Marquis, and Paul Finel as the Chevalier, with other soloists and the orchestra of Paris's Théâtre National de l'Opéra, conducted by Pierre Dervaux. Carmelites takes place during the tumultuous years of the French Revolution, and the opera's final scene depicts an event that occurred during the Revolution's final days, the execution of 16 Carmelite nuns from the monastery of Compiègne. By the way, it's correct to say monastery instead of convent when talking about the Carmelite order. The path that brought this story to the opera stage began with a book by the one nun who survived. In the opera, she's the strict, almost fanatical, but good-hearted Mother Marie of the Incarnation. Her book fascinated a German writer, Gertrude von der Fahr. Born in 1876, von der Fahr was well-educated in history and theology. That background was useful for her powerful novel, published in 1931, Die Letzte am Schafott, literally The Last at the Scaffold, but because it's Die Letzte and not Der Letzte, the implication of that title is actually The Last Woman at the Scaffold. The Carmelite nuns of Compiègne are there in the novel, but they're joined by a character that von der Fahr invented, her central character, in fact, Blanche de la Force. Note the name. In giving Blanche that French variation of her own last name, von der Fahr must have been longing for a more complete identification with the nuns of her story. She was also equating the Revolution's reign of terror with the rise of Nazism in her own time when she wrote this about Blanche. Born in the profound horror of a time darkened by the signs of destiny, this figure arose before me in some way as the embodiment of the mortal agony of an era going totally to its ruin. In 1938, Georges Bernanos, France's most distinguished Catholic writer, received a copy of The Last at the Scaffold from Father Raymond Bruck-Berger, a Dominican priest and theologian. Bruck-Berger envisioned Carmelites on film and thought only Bernanos could create the script. In 1947, Bruck-Berger and his friend, the distinguished cinematographer Philippe Agostini, helped Bernanos by preparing a scenario for a filmed version of the novel. Bernanos did write a script, but he died in 1948. 4 years later, the script was presented in Paris as a play. The film was eventually made, but not until 1960, with two renowned actresses, Jeanne Moreau and Madeleine Renaud, leading the cast. The Carmelites play was seen in 1952 by Poulenc, who was overwhelmed. He felt it would be a natural for opera, but who would commission him to compose it? Where could it be produced? Well, he didn't have to wait long. A commission came from Milan's famous music publishing house, Ricordi. They were acting on behalf of La Scala, where a new ballet was wanted. Poulenc had no trouble changing their minds. His previous opera had been a one-act comedy, but now that there was a chance to fulfill a long-held dream of writing a full-length operatic drama, he wasn't going to let anything interfere. Poulenc composed Carmelites as if possessed. His friends later commented about his suffering during this period. His emotional and spiritual commitment to the project brought on a nervous breakdown. There were also legal problems. According to Joseph Maklis, who eventually wrote the opera's authorized English translation, Bernanos's heirs had differences with Poulenc regarding the rights to the play, and they didn't start making a fuss about this until Poulenc had already finished half the opera. But the difficulties were resolved, and Carmelites reached La Scala at last. Text being so crucial in his vocal music, Poulenc wanted Carmelites always to be performed in the audience's own language. So, on January 26, 1957, the Milan public was introduced to a new opera called Dialoghi delle Carmelitane. Poulenc's emotions were probably even more intense when he heard Carmelites for the first time in his native French. in June the same year at the Opéra de Paris. America first heard Carmelites later in 1957 when NBC Opera Theater produced it for television. That autumn came its American stage premiere in San Francisco. Many European cities had heard it by the early 1960s, but it then seemed to fall by the wayside. Interest in it revived after the Metropolitan Opera premiere in 1977. During the past three decades, it's been staged frequently all over the world. Many critics rightly regard it as the summit in the career of one of the 20th century's greatest composers. Let's get to the story. We can be specific about when the opera's first and last scenes take place. For the first, the score says it's April 1789. If we go by historical fact, then the final scene takes place on July 17, 1794, 10 days before the French Revolution's reign of terror ended with the fall of Robespierre. The opera opens in the Paris home of an aristocrat, the Marquis de la Force. His son, the impetuous 20-something Chevalier, is worried about Blanche, his sister, who in the novel is only 16 years old. The Chevalier is upset that there's trouble in the streets. That means that Blanche may have a hard time getting home in her carriage. That leads the Marquis to bring up a sad memory from years before. He and his wife were driving home when they were surrounded by a crowd in a state of total chaos. It was on that night that the Marquis's wife died, having just given birth to Blanche. This is one of few moments in the opera where Poulenc lets his orchestration become almost too much for the singer. That churning, frantic accompaniment needs a bass baritone of Wagnerian power just to be heard amidst the barrage of sound. Le feu d'artifice commence, mais soudain des caisses de fusils s'enflamment. Voilà la panique qui s'empare de la foule. Comme la mer pousse le début de son carrosse, le cocher fouette les chevaux qui s'emballent. On arrête le carrosse.
Surviennent à temps pour dégager le carrosse. Quelques heures plus tard, revenu en cet hôtel, votre mère mourut en donnant le jour à Blanche.
The Chevalier finds that Blanche is constantly nervous and frightened. He thinks she may be seriously ill. The Marquis blames it on her youth. Blanche finally appears. Yes, there was a crowd interfering with her drive home. When we hear how she felt, we see that this is no ordinary girl. She's preoccupied, very serious, and at this moment there's somehow an aura of mystery about her. She says to her brother, "My God, maybe there was as much danger as there would be in going into cold water. First it takes your breath away, then you feel more comfortable once you've gone in up to your neck." Von Lafargue tells us that Blanche was, and I quote, "terrified of everything as a child, and now she's suffering even more from her weakness, so she's trying to hide it," close quote. Listen to Blanche's melody beginning with the words, "Mon Dieu, il en est peut-être du péril." That theme will return several times.
Qui vous a vu au carrefour Bussy vient de me dire qu'à travers vos glaces vous faisiez très bonne contenance.
Oh, monsieur de Damas n'a sans doute vu que ce qu'il voulait voir. Réellement, je faisais bonne contenance. Mon Dieu, il en est peut-être du péril. Chez les dames de la visitation a été très longue et m'a beaucoup fatiguée. Voilà sans doute pourquoi je déraisonne.
The Chevalier's just gone to see that the horses have been fed when his father is startled by a scream from Blanche's apartment. A servant, Thierry, appears to say that Blanche was possibly startled by his shadow on the wall. Blanche now reappears, surprising her father by asking permission to become a Carmelite. There's such grandeur here in Blanche's lines. She sings with such passion and such anguish. You sense her strong will, and that joining the Carmelite order is the only choice she has. The role requires a substantial sound for the climaxes. A voice strong enough to sing the Puccini repertoire manages well here.
Se tourmenterait pas pour un cri. On ne quitte pas le monde par dépit.
Je ne méprise pas le monde. Le monde est seulement pour moi comme un élément où je ne saurais vivre.
The Marquis is initially skeptical, but he finally lets his concern and his love for Blanche temper his response to her words. He makes her understand that only her conscience can tell her whether this will be the right decision. She desperately attempts to explain. She finds the world frightening and exhausting. It's her hope that the Carmelites will provide some relief for the fear that torments her. Von der Pfarr says this: "The poor child who had stubbornly refused all earthly guarantees of safety began to confide her little anxious heart to the shelter of the supreme power." For a model in constructing a musical framework to support the voices, Poulenc went back to operas as varied as those of Monteverdi, Mussorgsky, and Debussy. What brought them all into Poulenc's compositional orbit wasn't just that they'd all worked with tremendous economy of means, it was also their ability to blend musical episodes. Drama and music coalesce in Carmelites through recitative, arioso, that is, half aria, half recitative, and between-scene instrumental passages. Ultimately, you have a totally unified dramatic structure. There are wonderful lyrical passages for individual characters in Carmelites, but they're not arias per se. They remain indivisibly linked to what precedes and follows them, and you can't really pull them out of context. We're now at the Carmelite monastery, in the receiving room of Madame de Croissy, the Reverend Mother. In the score, she's also identified as la prieure, the prioress. She's a woman in late middle age whose debilitating illness is unfortunately taking its toll. She does take Blanche seriously, but at the same time she wonders if this girl isn't frightened by the Carmelite's severe rules. Quite the opposite. "They attract me," replies Blanche. When Croissy wonders what brought Blanche to the order, Blanche declares that she's seeking an heroic life. Croissy suspects that Blanche is thinking this would be easy to achieve as a Carmelite. Blanche is mortified to hear that. "She'd never be so calculating," she says. Listen to the dialogue's quickness at the start. It needs the pacing of real conversation. Poulenc lets us concentrate totally on the words by keeping the accompaniment minimal or eliminating it completely.
Qui vous pousse au Carmel? Votre révérence m'ordonne-t-elle? Parlez tout à fait franchement.
Oui.
Eh bien, l'attrait d'une vie héroïque, l'attrait d'une vie héroïque, ou celui d'une certaine manière de vivre qui vous paraît bien à temps, devoir rendre l'héroïsme plus facile, le mettre, pour ainsi dire, à la portée de la main.
Pardonnez-moi, je n'ai jamais fait de tels calculs.
Les plus dangereux de nos calculs sont ceux
puisse avoir des illusions. Je ne demanderai pas mieux qu'on m'en dépouille.
It's most important to Madame de Croissy to reiterate to Blanche that this is a house of prayer, and that prayer alone justifies the nuns' lives. Blanche feels that the Carmelites can be her only refuge, but Croissy very firmly responds that this is not the order's purpose. She becomes a bit more gentle in asking Blanche if she's thought of a name for herself should she be admitted to the order. The prioress is visibly moved when Blanche reveals the name, Sister Blanche of the Agony of Christ. In this last dialogue, again, the accompaniment is very restrained. We want to concentrate on textual colors which project Croissy's sudden warmth and Blanche's shining conviction.
Notre règle n'est pas un refuge, ce n'est pas la règle qui nous porte, ma fille, c'est nous qui gardons la règle. Dites-moi encore, avez-vous, par extraordinaire, déjà choisi votre nom de carmélite? Au cas où nous vous admettrions en l'approbation. Mais sans doute n'y avez-vous jamais pensé. Si folle, ma mère, je voudrais m'appeler Solébrance de l'agonie du Christ. Allez en
In the excerpts that you've heard so far, you've probably realized that you're not really hearing vocalizing. That is, Poulenc isn't having one syllable cover a large number of notes, or even two or three notes. It's one note per syllable of text. That's another way he reinforces the idea of conversation. In the time that elapses between scene two and scene three, Blanche is indeed admitted to the order. When we next see her, she's in the nuns' workroom with the young Sister Constance de Saint-Denis. Constance, who has a sunny, bubbly nature, is gaily recalling her brother's wedding. Blanche is shocked that she'd talk in this carefree way during these days when the prioress is so ill. Poulenc uses an especially bustling orchestral underpinning, but he keeps Constance at the higher end of her range. A light but well-focused soprano voice can easily penetrate through the instruments. Constance is always totally sincere. That's important, especially for what follows in this scene. She confesses that she'd willingly give up her own life to save the prioress, and she admits to having no fear of death herself. Constance does feel that Blanche somehow intends to harm her. Blanche instead confesses to envying her. That astonishes Constance, especially considering how thoughtlessly she's been talking when the prioress is so ill. She begs Blanche's help in changing her ways and suggests that they both kneel and offer their lives for that of the prioress. To Blanche, this is absurd. Constance then shocks Blanche again. She explains that she's always hoped for a short life and that when she met Blanche, she knew that they would die together. Blanche is now appalled. She cries, "I forbid you to say such things." Listen for that beautiful theme we heard from Blanche in scene one. When she sang about jumping into danger, it was the same music that you hear from Constance now when she's talking about dying with Blanche.
J'ai toujours souhaité mourir jeune. Que je fais dans cette comédie? Eh bien, la
The scene ends with a bewildered Constance murmuring apologetically, "I didn't think what I said would offend you." We move now to Madame de Croissy's bedroom. She's expecting Blanche, who is late. Croissy speaks with her second-in-command, Mother Marie of the Incarnation, about her years as a Carmelite. Despite meditating on death for her entire adult life, she's now in physical and mental agony, and anguished at the thought of showing her face to the nuns in her charge. As the last new nun of her term as prioress, Blanche is a source of concern to Croissy. She entrusts Blanche to Mother Marie. "In the name of obedience," says Croissy, "you will answer for her to me before God." The kind of power needed for Croissy's singing here is intimidating. It needs a dramatically scaled instrument, although it's central enough in range so both mezzo-sopranos and contraltos can do it. If you know Wagner's Ring cycle, think of Fricka and Erda combined. It's tough for voices of this type to project with a lot of power smack in the middle range, but that's what's needed. And then, at the end, suddenly there's a huge pile-driving octave leap. When Blanche appears, Croissy gives her some final words of wisdom and a sad farewell. "You are the dearest to my heart of all my daughters," she confesses, "like a child of old age. No matter what happens, never depart from the way of simplicity. God has taken your honor upon himself, and it's safer in his hands than in yours." After Blanche leaves the room, Croissy asks her physician, Monsieur Javelinot, for some more medicine, but he thinks another dose will be too much for her. As pain begins to overwhelm her, so does terror. She has a vision of the Carmelites' chapel, empty and desecrated. She feels that they've been deserted by God. As the music gets more dramatic and Croissy's agony becomes harrowing for her and for us, it becomes almost impossible for the singer to adhere to the written notes. In the last phrase of this excerpt, you'll hear Croissy cry out, "Oh, que ne puis-je arracher ce masque avec mes ongles? Oh, if I could tear off this mask with my nails!"
Je viens de voir notre chapelle vide et profanée. L'hôtel fondé de la paille et du sang sur les dalles.
Que ne puis-je arracher ce masque avec mes ongles ?
When Blanche returns, she witnesses the final agony of Croissy, who cries out, "Death! Fear! Fear of death!" before collapsing dead on the bed. Blanche's grief overwhelms her as Act One ends. You've probably sensed that every scene in this opera is its own perfect entity. Each specific episode, however brief, is so effective because of the incredible individuality of every line. Whether it's Blanche, Madame de Croissy, the Chevalier, the moment each character sings, it's obvious immediately that, musically speaking, those lines can belong only to that person. If you look at Blanche and then Constance, you can't possibly imagine the one's music being sung by the other. Poulenc didn't just have innate dramatic insight. He also had behind him a lifetime of writing songs, and that gave him a total connection to the accents and inflections of the French language. And as for the explosions of emotion from Madame de Croissy that you just heard, what were they? Recitative? Aria? It doesn't matter. The point is simply that we're experiencing a brilliant line-by-line response to text on Poulenc's part. It seems incredible that he was able to achieve such heights of eloquence in this work, given that operatic drama was for him an entirely new world as a composer. Probably few people expected that he'd be capable of this kind of piece. This was, after all, the same man whose sense of humor was legendary. In 1945, he actually wrote an irresistible work for two pianos, later adapted for orchestra, based on the story of Babar the elephant. But Poulenc had a deep spirituality, too. He'd experienced a renewal of his Catholicism after the death of a dear friend in an auto accident in 1936. The miracle of Carmelites was that it united Poulenc's theatrical and musical gifts with his profound religious faith. Back to the story of the opera. Act Two opens in the chapel of the Carmelites, with Blanche and Constance guarding Croissy's coffin. After they pray together, Constance leaves to find the nuns who will take over for them. Once Blanche is alone, she becomes frightened and starts to run out of the chapel, but seemingly out of nowhere, Mother Marie appears. At first, she's furious that Blanche would leave her post, but she sees how apprehensive this girl is, and her manner becomes gentle, motherly, really. She offers to lead Blanche back to her cell. Listen to the build-up to the first sung lines here, the perfect musical equivalent of Blanche's increasing terror. The a cappella beginning of this conversation is written so characterfully. The fact that the line takes Mother Marie all the way up to high B flat is a great indication of how outraged she is. Mother Marie suggests that Blanche go to bed, make the sign of the cross, and sleep. "I formally exempt you from any other prayer," she tells her. "Tomorrow, your mistake will cause more pain in you than shame. You'll ask God's pardon without risking that you'll offend him any further." Now comes the opera's real heart, in the first of what Poulenc terms interludes, meant to take place in front of the curtain. Blanche and Constance are carrying flowers to welcome the new prioress, whoever she may be. Constance wants Mother Marie to be given the position. Blanche is a bit abrupt with Constance when she says, "Do you always believe that God is going to act according to your wishes?" The depth of the young Constance's thoughts is amazing, and this is the best example. She wonders if, in dying so painfully, Madame de Croissy was experiencing someone else's death. We can almost see the ingenuous expression on her face at this moment. In choosing this death for her, Constance says, God was making it easier for another person to die when the time comes. We die for each other, she concludes, sometimes in place of each other. Who knows? The gentleness of this passage is unique, even sublime, especially when the theme we heard earlier appears again. The excerpt begins with Blanche's shocked words, "La mort d'une autre?" The death of someone else? We move to the monastery's chapter house. The nuns have gathered to give obedience to the new prioress. Sometimes it's staged that each nun kneels and kisses the prioress's hand during the instrumental prelude. The surprise is that it's not Mother Marie, but Madame Lidoine. Her first appearance before the nuns is very dignified, but also very warm at the same time. She does the right thing by first offering the nuns comfort after the loss of Madame de Croissy. Lidoine makes no attempt to predict what the future will hold, but clearly she knows that times are not going to be easy for the Carmelites. This is a departure from what we've heard from the other principals up to now in terms of sheer vocalism. There's almost Italianate singing. For a voice that we might hear as, say, Leonora in Verdi's Il Trovatore, blooming and womanly, with nobility coloring every phrase, but it's still one syllable per note. Even though it's a long speech by one person, there still has to be that element of conversation about it. Madame Lidoine's own origins are humble. She describes herself as awaiting only the modest virtues of holy providence that the rich and powerful gladly despise: goodwill, patience, and the spirit of conciliation. Most important to her is to urge the nuns to remember that they should resist anything that detracts from their devotion to prayer. Even martyrdom must be rejected, for martyrdom is a reward, whereas prayer is a duty. The douane then turns to Mother Marie and asks her for an appropriate way to conclude this little talk. Mother Marie chooses to lead the nuns in an Ave Maria, in which Madame Le Douane joins. If you've had any experience singing in choirs, chances are you've sung some Poulenc. He composed some of the most breathtakingly beautiful choral music of the 20th century, and this brief but exquisite, floating Ave Maria is an especially memorable example. We don't know how much time goes by between Le Douane's arrival and the next scene, but we now have another interlude. A gentleman has arrived at the monastery asking to speak with the Reverend Mother. Knowing she can trust Marie to ask the right questions, Le Douane asks her to go and inquire as to what the Carmelites can do for this man. Marie discovers that it's Blanche's brother asking to see her before going abroad. The nuns don't normally accept visitors, but Le Douane feels the rules can be broken in this case, and she asks Marie to fetch Blanche. Now we get a bit of the tension that exists in the Marie-Le Douane relationship. Le Douane insists that Marie remain in the room for the conversation between brother and sister. "You alone," orders Le Douane, "and no one else." Blanche meets with her brother in the parlor. The Chevalier explains that he's there to express his concern for Blanche's safety, their father's concern for her too. The Chevalier believes that only fear keeps Blanche with the Carmelites, or perhaps it's the fear of fear. Blanche's brother senses that she's receiving him coolly. She tries to explain that it's simply that she's not yet used to living a happy life, which is what she is enjoying with the Carmelites. When he asks if she's no longer afraid, she declares that no one can harm her where she is. And she says this with more serenity than we've sensed in her so far in the opera.
Blanche, lorsque je suis entrée tout à l'heure, que s'en est fallu que vous tombiez en faiblesse, et j'ai cru voir, dans la lueur de ce mauvais quinquet, en une seconde.
No!
Blanche now hopes that her brother will look at her as a comrade in battle, for it really is a battle that she's anticipating, in which everyone will have to participate as he sees fit. The Chevalier finally realizes that Blanche is adamant, and he sadly leaves. She then crumples in anguish. She asks Mother Marie if her family will ever consider her anything more than a child. She believes that she's been proud, and that, as a result, she'll somehow be punished. A further word about Blanche. Her performance history has developed rather unexpectedly. A soprano created the role, but nowadays lyric sopranos and lyric mezzos sing it. The point is contrast. As long as she doesn't sound like the other principals, and as long as she has the range, the intensity, the edginess for the role, as well as the lyricism, the vocal category doesn't ultimately matter very much. The next scene begins with the nun's chaplain informing them that he's been relieved of his responsibilities. The Carmelites join him in a final prayer. Blanche worries that if the chaplain is apprehended by the revolutionary forces, he'll be killed. An excited crowd is heard outside, terrifying the nuns. The chaplain leaves, but soon returns to temporary safety with the Carmelites, although he is reluctant in placing them in even greater danger. This is one of the opera's more active scenes. You hear the crowd demanding to be led into the monastery, then the chaplain's return, and Marie's calm order that the door be opened.
Je ne saurais que vous compromettre. Il faut que je parte lorsque le cortège sera rassemblé. Sur la place de la municipalité, les rues seront libres.
Écoutez, écoutez.
J'ai peut-être trop attendu. Que deviendriez-vous, mes filles, s'il me prenait chez vous?
Ouvrez la porte! Ouvrez la porte!
Four officers stride in. One reads the revolution's declaration of expulsion. The nuns' activities must cease, and they must dress as ordinary citizens. Marie confronts that officer. No matter what we wear, we'll only be servants. We don't need servants, but the people need martyrs, and that is a function we can fulfill. In times like these, dying doesn't mean anything. Life itself has been so thoroughly devalued as to be worth nothing. The officer replies that her words would cost her greatly were she faced with any other officer but himself. He confides that he'd served in the past as the church's sacristan. He informs Marie that the nuns will be alone until evening when workmen will appear. He leaves after warning Marie against a certain blacksmith who is an informer. An older nun, Mother Jeanne, hands Blanche the monastery's small statue of the infant Jesus, hoping that it will bring her comfort. Hearing the noise of the angry crowd outside, Blanche suddenly drops the statue, which breaks into pieces. Listen to how each line defines character. The music makes perfectly clear the comfort being offered by Mother Jeanne, the total fragility of Blanche, and the sheer conviction of Mother Marie. I've always found it fascinating to look at operas in which communities are presented, whether it's Nuremberg in Die Meistersinger, a Czech village in Yenufa, or Catfish Row in Porgy and Bess. That's how I feel about Carmelites. We're looking at the community of this monastery of Compiègne. The relationships are there, Croissy and Mother Marie, Lidoine and Mother Marie, Blanche and Constance, the chaplain and the nuns. We can so easily believe in them as individuals and as a group. Their interaction, the decisions they make in crises, their responses to the time in which they live, this all becomes matters of urgent importance to us as their audience. Act 3 takes us back to the chapel, now desecrated. Madame Lidoine is away in Paris, so Mother Marie is in charge. The chaplain is there, which is important to Marie, since she would like him to be present when she drops a bomb, figuratively speaking. She suggests that the nuns take the vow of martyrdom. It's decided to have a secret vote, and Marie will withdraw her proposal if there's even one person dissenting. Each nun comes to the chaplain to whisper in his ear yes or no. Marie then announces that there was indeed one opposing vote. We assume that it's to spare Blanche mortifying embarrassment that Constance declares, "The vote was mine! I beg you to let me change it!" As usual in this opera, when Poulenc wants to draw attention to text, he does the humblest thing he could do. He pulls away most of the accompaniment and, setting the text naturally, simply lets the beautiful words speak for themselves. Constance's lines, which move so quickly from agitated excitement to sweetness, are specially touching. Toward the end of this excerpt, you'll also hear the chaplain asking the nuns to approach him two by two to take the vow. The nuns are about to take the vow when Blanche rushes out in a panic. We then have an interlude in which an officer gives the nuns various regulations for their new life. Listen to the macho confidence of these lines and how purposely inexpressive Poulenc makes them. Pas de vie de communauté, the officer begins. You can't live as a community any longer.
Pas de vie de communauté. Pas de relation avec les ennemis de la République, ni avec les prêtres réfractaires, si pour les papes et les tyrans. Dans 10 minutes, vous viendrez prendre une à une au bureau le certificat qui vous permettra de jouir de nouveau des bienfaits de la liberté sous la surveillance des lois.
Madame Lidoine asks that the nuns' priest be informed that it would be too dangerous for them to celebrate Mass as they'd planned. Mother Marie, as we've seen already, believes in speaking her mind, and she now questions Lidoine. Is this sort of caution in keeping with the martyr's vow? Li Duan calmly responds that each nun must answer to God for her vow, but she will answer for all of them before God. Here's Li Duan at her most imposing. Her dignified, restrained vocal line simply exudes authority. This is a woman who knows who she is and her purpose on earth. We return to the home of the de la Force family, now taken over by the revolution, perhaps even by the Marquis's own servants. Blanche is in the salon, now something of a mess. Mother Marie arrives, intent on taking Blanche with her. Blanche is desperately trying to convince herself that she's safe where she is, but she's miserable, and she confesses to Marie that she's now a servant in her father's house. She nearly breaks down in revealing that her father died on the guillotine a few days before. She feels totally unworthy of him and the name she carries. Finally, she cries out, "Hier, ils m'ont frappé! Yesterday, they struck me!" One can imagine this whole scene reducing Poulenc to an emotional wreck as he was writing it. Of all moments in the hyper-emotional role of Blanche, this one needs an astounding vocal actress with so many deep feelings to put across: doubt, loneliness, frustration, grief, and above all, fear. Ignoring Blanche's sobs, Marie addresses her as Sister Blanche of the Agony of Christ. Just hearing the name forces Blanche to compose herself. "I'm going to give you an address," says Marie. "Remember it well. Mademoiselle Rose Ducor, 2 rue Saint-Denis. You'll be safe there." Marie will await her at that address until the next night, but Blanche isn't ready to go. You'll hear an unidentified voice from offstage yelling, "Blanche! Les commissions! Blanche, your errands!" She rushes out of the room. When you hear Rita Gore sing that line, "Mademoiselle Rose Ducor, 2 rue Saint-Denis," you'll hear the best possibility for sheer vocal magnificence that Poulenc can offer a singer in this opera. Mother Marie equates vocally with Amneris in Verdi's Aida, an imposing, richly dramatic voice, able to communicate both intimately and in huge pronouncements like this one. The next interlude is entirely spoken. Two old women and an old man are commenting that times continue to be difficult. Blanche, passing by, is curious when one woman says she's from Compiègne and reveals that the nuns there have been arrested. Blanche is asked if she has relatives in Compiègne. She lies. "I've only been in Paris for 8 days. I came from Roche-sur-Yon with my employers." Once she's out of earshot, one of the women mutters, "Strange sort of servant, that one." We move to the Conciergerie. In today's Paris, this building is part of the Palais de Justice on the Île de la Cité. During the Revolution, it functioned as a prison, housing such important figures as Marie Antoinette. The nuns are all there except Blanche and Mother Marie. Madame Lidoine comforts them at the end of their first night in prison. She encourages them by finally taking the martyr's vow that they had taken at the monastery in her absence. Constance pipes up that thanks to a dream she had, she's convinced that Blanche will return to them. The jailer appears and lists the name of each nun aloud before announcing that for defying the law, by meeting in secret, plotting against the revolution, corresponding with enemies, and other crimes undertaken in the name of God, the nuns are condemned to death. The music here requires a certain menace, which Poulenc achieves initially through a hammering quality in the vocal line, and then through the snarl that the final phrases provoke in the voice. The power and vehemence of this brief role make quite an impact.
Votre tenue des correspondances fanatiques, conservez des écrits liberticides, ne forme qu'une réunion de rebelles, de séditieuses, qui nourrissent dans leur cœur le désir et l'espoir criminel de voir le peuple français remis au fer de ses tyrans et la liberté engloutie dans des flots de sang que leurs infâmes
After the jailer leaves, Madame Lidoine gives the nuns her maternal blessing. If ever the nuns needed comfort, it's now. You can hear how Lidoine sounds almost transfigured by her devotion to them all. There's a majesty in her blazing leap to high A, but then, in those final words, avec ma maternelle bénédiction, the sound flows over the nuns as a calm after a storm. In the final interlude, the chaplain informs Mother Marie that the nuns are condemned. The dishonor Marie feels is overwhelming. She's in despair at the thought that they'll meet their deaths without her joining them. She's rushing off to be with them, but the chaplain stops her, saying simply that her fate must remain in God's hands. In the final scene, we're on the Place de la Révolution. It's July 17th, 1794. A crowd is ready to watch the executions. The nuns are brought to the square, and they begin the Salve Regina prayer together. One voice after another drops out as each nun dies on the guillotine. The last is Constance, who suddenly turns to the crowd in despair. When Constance sees Blanche emerging from the crowd, we hear one final time that exquisite theme from Act One, reminding us that Constance knew that she and Blanche would die together. Constance then goes to her death in absolute calm. Blanche then sings, but doesn't complete, the last verse of the Veni Creator prayer as she walks to the guillotine. After the blade descends, the crowd disperses quietly. Nothing in opera, and I mean nothing, affects audiences the way the Carmelites finale does. What's happened is horrifying, but the nobility and the serenity with which these nuns deal with their last moments can only be called uplifting. After witnessing this scene, anyone will come away cleansed. I think of the words of Poulenc's first Blanche, the Romanian soprano Virginia Țeani, who said, "When I came off stage at the end, I wasn't in tears. I was in ecstasy." Lyric Opera Chicago thanks EMI Classics for permission to use the recording heard in this commentary. Thank you for listening.